This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Sanders is going to be with us this hour to do brunch with Bernie. And then Mitch McConnell scheduled a floor vote. And so he is up on the floor of the Senate right at this moment voting, as far as I know. You've got that channel to the House recording studio open, right? So, when Bernie arrives, if Bernie arrives, I think it's probably going to be when, as soon as the votes are over, then he's going to hop back into the seat and take your calls for brunch with Bernie. We're doing it a day early today because of his travel schedule. So, that said, Jeb Bush yesterday, rather infamously, came out and said, "My aspiration for the country, and I believe we can achieve it, is 4% growth as far as the eye can see." Now, you know, first of all, let me say 4% growth as far as the eye can see. There is a way to do that. The only time in the history of the United States when we had four consecutive decades of growth above 3% GDP, annual GDP, four consecutive decades, was the 1940s, the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, and the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then came Reagan. Now, if Jeb Bush is going to continue Reaganomics, you're not going to get this. But he's got a new strategy, right? Did you get the clip of George W. Bush talking about the All-American family? No? Okay. Well, remember back during the 2004 campaign, and George W. Bush had this woman up on stage, and he says, "So you're working?" And she's like, "Yeah, I work three jobs." And he says, "Oh, isn't that just great? That's the all-American story." I don't think working three jobs should be the all-American story. But in any case, apparently George Bush's brother Jeb, or John, actually, John Ellis Bush, thinks that it is. Because he said, "My aspiration for the country, and I believe we can achieve it, is 4% growth as far as the eye can see, which means that we have to be a lot more productive. It means that people need to work longer hours." So, clip 11 here. This is what. Oh, Bernie's here with us?
How are you?
Okay, great. I was just going to play a clip of Senator Sanders, but apparently he is joining us.
Senator? Hello. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you so much for stepping off the floor vote and being with us. How does hour look for you?
Good. We'll probably be zigging in and out. There are some votes on the elementary and secondary education bill. But picking up on your point, I heard what you Jeb Bush had said. And I think many people don't know this, Tom, and I've been talking about this a lot around the country, is that because of the collapse of the American middle class and because of wages have not kept pace with inflation for many, many years, the truth is that the American people today are working longer hours than are the people of any other major industrialized countries. And the Japanese are very, very hardworking people. We work 137 hours a year more than the Japanese, 260 more hours per year than the British, and almost 500 hours a year more than our good friends in France. And when Bush talks about Americans having to work longer hours, what he should know is that 85% of working men and 66% of working women are already working more than 40 hours a week.
Wow.
So you got a situation now, and we don't talk about it, but I get around the country and I see people, and they are stressed out. It's impacting family life. It's impacting a parent's relationship to their kids. It's impacting whether or not families are going to have more children. I often tell the story of a woman I met in Burlington, Vermont, a couple of years ago, and she said that, you know, she's working three jobs. Her husband's working two jobs. They have one child. They want more children, but they just don't think they could be the kind of parents they want to be under those conditions. And that's speaking for millions of people. Meanwhile, there has been a huge increase in worker productivity, explosion of technology. So the question is, why are people working such incredibly long hours? Why do we work longer hours than any other major country? And the answer is that most of the new wealth and income generated from this new technology is going into the top 1%, the top 2%. And that's the issue that we've got to deal with. So I think to Governor Bush, his idea that the American people are working should work longer hours, well, I disagree. I think maybe we need an economy that works for the middle class and working families where wages and income go up, not that people need another job on top of the two jobs they already have.
Yeah. Senator, Donald Trump is climbing in the polls, and I have a theory which they seem they were twisting themselves like a pretzel last night on MSNBC not to discuss. And that is that he's not just shouting out to the racist base in the Republican Party, but he's also talking about trade. In fact, you and he are the only two candidates that I know of running for president who are talking about how crazy our trade policies are. And I think his discussion of trade is catching some Republicans' interest. I think your discussion of trade is catching some Republicans' interest and independents' interest. So I'm curious of your thoughts. Isn't it that we need more jobs?
Well,
more
hours? I get nervous when people put me in the same sentence as Donald Trump.
My apologies. But no, my point is that there are no other candidates who are willing to discuss the failure
the
of these trade policies.
You know, Tom, on issue after issue, what one sees, and I see this increasingly because I've been running around the country. We just came back from Portland, Maine, and you know, I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and Denver, and Minneapolis, gone all over the country. And what you appreciate to a significant degree is the incredible gap, the disconnect that exists between Washington and the rest of the country. I mean, this is like a bubble isolated from the real world. And in terms of trade, what most people understand, that our trade policies for the last 30, 40 years, trade policies like NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China have been a disaster. It's hard to look at the facts and not acknowledge that reality. These trade agreements have been pushed by large multinational corporations with a very simple goal. Why do you want to pay? Why do they want to pay an American worker $20-$25 an hour, provide health care, have to obey environmental regulations, when you can go to countries like China or Vietnam or other low-wage countries, pay people very low wages, don't worry about environment, don't worry about unions, and then you can bring your products back into this country tariff-free. It's a no-brainer for them, and that's exactly what they have been doing. It is why we have lost, one of the reasons, not the only reason, as to why we have lost some 60,000 factories since 2001 and millions of decent-paying jobs. Everybody knows that except the people here in Washington who receive huge amounts of money from corporate America and from Wall Street who think these trade agreements are great, and for them they are great. It is great for them to pay people a buck an hour or $2 an hour rather than $25 an hour to an American worker. So to the degree that Trump or anyone else is raising that issue, yes, I think it is going to resonate. And by the way, on this issue, it may well be that Republicans actually feel more strongly about this issue than do Democrats.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing. We have about 40 seconds till the break. Thoughts on what's going on right now?
Well, the other thing that concerns me is that, and an issue that I have been talking about, and we'll talk about longer later in the program, is how far removed the United States is from so many other countries in protecting the needs of the middle class, not only in terms of health care, but in terms of family and medical leave, in terms of paid sick time, and in terms of paid overtime. It's incredible. We talk about the long hours that the American people work. There are many jobs, Tom, that are being offered today. And you know how much vacation time they have? They include?
No.
Zero.
Ugh.
So they want people to only work 52 weeks a year. What's the problem there?
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour a day early. We're live. It's Thursday. Senator Sanders is on the phone with us. He will be taking your calls right after the break. So please stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Our first hour of the Thursday show today. We are live right now. Give us a call. And welcome back. Let's see here. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia.
Hi.
Hey, Danette.
Hi,
you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Danette.
Hi there. You're going to be hearing from me a lot over the course of your time with Tom's listeners. I love that you do this, and I really, that is the number one reason why I support you, is that you're willing to talk to us American citizens, and you value what we think, and that is very, very important. My question, and I had a hard time phrasing it, is, do you foresee that any of what the current Congress has put in motion or what President Obama has negotiated with world leaders and other things that are in the works, do you foresee any of the current stuff that's on y'all's plate derailing what it is that you plan to do when you become president of the United States?
Well, thank you very much for that call, and thank you very much for your support. The one area where the president and John Kerry have been working very, very hard on is trying to reach an agreement with the Iranian government to make sure that they do not develop nuclear weapons, while at the same time they can have nuclear weapons for their civilian use. And it has been a very, very rocky process. We just met with the president a few days ago. I think it's fair to say that a month ago he was more optimistic about an agreement being reached. We will see what happens. We'll find out soon enough. But I surely hope that an agreement is reached, because the alternatives are not good. I think in terms of the Middle East, my goal is, and I think the president's goal, is to see that we get Muslim countries themselves on the ground fighting for the soul of Islam. We need Saudi Arabia, which has the third largest military budget in the world. We need Turkey. We need other countries to take on ISIS. They cannot simply believe or be allowed to believe that it's going to be the United States of America year after year, decade after decade, who does it for them. So those are a couple of areas where I think the president and I are on the same page.
Okay. Let's see here. Richard in Pittsburgh, Mass. Richard, we have just a minute to the break. Real quick question for Bernie.
Yeah, Bernie. I sent $100 for you a few months ago, but Bernie, I really love you talking about our trade. It's really, we're getting screwed on it. I like that about you, but we're really getting screwed on all these illegals in this country. They're coming in by the millions on visas, and the politicians don't even have a bill where they keep track of whether or not they overstay their visas.
Let's let Bernie respond to that.
Okay, Richard, thanks for the question. And there are two aspects of your question. First of all, on the trade issue, thank you. And I think it's a huge issue, and I think we need to fundamentally rethink trade. Obviously, what goes on now is the loss of good-paying jobs, and that has got to change. We want corporate America not just to be investing in China. We want them to be investing in the United States of America and creating jobs here. In terms of the immigration issue, I see it as a two-pronged issue, Richard.
Let's dig into that with a little more elbow room here right after the break.
Thanks.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be and we're live. It's Thursday. We'll be right back. You may have to hop out throughout this hour and vote upstairs. But, Senator, the last caller was asking your thoughts on immigration.
In general. Yeah. So let me divide it in two parts. Richard, number one, we have about 11 million undocumented workers, people in this country. Some of them have been here for many, many years. It is my strong view that we need a path towards citizenship for those people. But I think the second part of your question asked about, I think, the guest worker program is what I think you were referring to. And they have programs like the H-2A program, the H-1B program. And I have historically had real concerns about those programs. We have heard from a lot of high-tech workers, people involved in computer programming and so forth, who are saying, this program, this guest worker program, is bringing in folks from Russia and other countries at lower wages than American workers in the high-tech industry get. And I have serious concerns about that, and I've offered amendments to deal with that issue. The second part of it is that there is in the immigration bill language that would bring in a lot of low-wage workers, unskilled workers, and that I have had a very difficult time understanding. When we have youth unemployment in this country, where if you're white and you're 17 to 20 and you're a high school graduate or a dropout, it's 33%. If you're Hispanic, it's 36%. If you're black, it's 51%. These kids desperately need jobs, and they need jobs starting at the very bottom so that they could eventually get the experience and work their way up. And I just don't know why we need to be bringing in a whole lot of other folks who are not skilled at low-wage jobs. So that has been a concern of mine. What I got into the last immigration bill passed the Senate, which alleviated some of my concerns a little bit, was an amendment for $1.5 billion, which would provide jobs and educational opportunities for young people. Right now, it is summertime. You have a lot of kids hanging out on street corners. They should be working. There's enough work to be done. We should provide them with jobs. So that's kind of my view on that issue, Richard.
Sandy in Norwood, North Carolina. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I'm wondering how this ISDS is going to affect our sovereignty and the office of the president and our court system. Is it going to make it, you know, like hamper it? And what can we do about it? Are we going to be able to be effective at all?
Sandy, thank you very much for that question. When we talk about trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, usually what we're talking about are jobs, and that is an enormous part of it. For example, I have real concerns about American workers as part of the TPP being forced to compete against workers in Vietnam where the minimum wage is 56 cents an hour, not to mention that workers there can't form unions or express themselves politically. But what Sandy is raising is another issue which is also of enormous consequence, and that is the investor-state dispute settlement process. And it sounds kind of complicated, but it's really not. I will give you the best example that I can about my concerns about the ISDS. A tiny country, Uruguay, had a president who was an oncologist, concerned about cancer. This guy and his legislature there, this tiny country, worked hard to do everything they could to get their kids, to prevent their kids from smoking and prevent their population from smoking. So they waged a very strong anti-tobacco campaign. And I think that makes enormous sense. What happened is that Philip Morris took the tiny country to Uruguay to an international tribunal and sued them. And why did Philip Morris sue them? Because they had the same language under another trade agreement, which said that Uruguay is negatively impacting the future profits of Philip Morris. So here you have a country trying to protect the health of their people being sued by a company, Philip Morris, who says, hey, you're not giving us the opportunity to get into your markets so that your kids can get cancer and emphysema and other diseases. You're hurting our future profits. And that's before an international tribunal, and we don't know how that tribunal will rule. Clearly, countries, states have the right to protect the health of their people and the environment of their people without having to worry about being sued by some large multinational because it might impact their future profits. But that tells you almost everything you need to know about the TPP and what's behind it. It is profits for large multinationals.
Carol in Murris Inlet, South Carolina. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, it's an honor to speak with you. My husband and I are both supporters going way back to your Senate campaign when we lived in Atlanta. We were involved with GSA. Anyway, I was hoping that you could update us. And, in fact, a lot of people don't know about your dental health bill that you co-sponsored. If you could tell us something about that, because we're on a fixed income. My husband has Parkinson's, and he's had a lot of dental issues. And
Carol, we just have a half a minute left for Bernie on this.
Let me thank Carol for raising an issue, Tom, that we do not raise enough. Today in America, if you think that Carol and her husband are the only people who can't find affordable, accessible dental care, you would be sorely mistaken. Tens of millions of people are in that boat. I've introduced comprehensive legislation which would greatly, greatly expand the ability of the American people to get affordable dental care. We have worked hard on the National Health Service Corps, which would provide debt forgiveness for young dentists graduating dental school who are going to practice in underserved areas. As the former chairman of the Veterans Committee, I worked hard to expand dental care for our veterans as well. So Carol touches on an issue that we don't talk about enough, and that is the crisis for affordable dental care in this country.
Great. Senator, do you think you'll still be with us in 6 minutes?
What I'm going to do is run up and vote, and I will be back in a few minutes.
Okay. And if you're not here, I'm going to play some clips from your last speech.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. We'll be right back with more of Brunch with Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Yeah, Bernie, one way or the other, either live and in person or by clips. But he's going to go vote. He'll be right back. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Sanders, are you back?
I am right back, and I think we're in pretty good shape, Tom, because I think we'll have some votes later, but not in the immediate.
So you were able to just run up and vote. That's wonderful.
Okay.
Let's pick up some more calls here then. Brian in Schaumburg, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
It's an honor to speak with you, gentlemen. Just a variation on the employment problem we're having in this country. You know, I'm an electrician. I've worked on a service truck, so I've seen a lot of businesses. I've seen their entire operations. And a different tact I'd like to hear talked about is, let's talk about all the American small businesses that cheat. They engage in paying people under the table cash, predominantly illegal immigrants. And I know the big evil corporations are doing a lot of bad things. But let's talk about the American citizens that own a small business of maybe 10 guys and say they're landscaping or whatever, and they're paying their illegal immigrants cash. And then the immigrant's wife, you know, they have children, and then their children are getting benefits because they're shown as being impoverished. And then their children are American citizens, and then they get subsidized by the taxpayer. The whole thing is upside down. We need both parties to be honest about immigration. We need to dial it down, and we need to pursue employers that are cheating left and right.
Well, Brian, thanks a lot for raising a very important issue. Although I don't think we have the time to get into it in great, great, great length right now, but let me just say this. During the Reagan, and Tom, you feel free to chime in on this as well, because I think Brian raised a good issue.
Sure.
During the Reagan and Bush 1 periods, these were guys who were tough on crime. They were pro, police and all that stuff. And yet we had huge amounts of immigrants coming in. Does anybody not believe for one second that people who crossed the border illegally understood that there were going to be jobs available for them and that their employer would look the other way? Tom?
Yeah, no. Ronald Reagan, after the amnesty thing or whatever you want to call it, essentially stopped enforcing the law that prosecuted largely white, largely wealthy employers.
No, right.
You know, for
so here's
people
the point.
Without documentation.
People come across the border for, 99% of the cases for one reason. They need jobs. Their families are hungry. They have no future. And complicit in that whole process were employers who knew exactly what was going on. In 2007, I was in Immokalee, Florida. Nobody knows where Immokalee, Florida is except the people of Florida. It's a town near Naples. It is one of the leading areas in the country for tomato, growing of tomatoes, the kind of tomatoes used at McDonald's and Burger King and so forth. Most of the workers there were undocumented. Every single person went there, and they were exploited ruthlessly. Ruthlessly. And I went down there in 2007 to try to stand with those workers to make sure that that exploitation in terms of wages, horrendously low wages, terrible working conditions, horrible housing, we tried to do something about it. We did have some impact. Point is, everybody there knew what was going on. And everyone turned a blind eye to it. That is why, and with the exploitation of these workers, it impacts every other worker in America because it is part of the race to the bottom. If you can exploit people, undocumented workers, then you're going to be paying lower wages to people who are citizens.
Yeah.
So that is why we need a orderly, intelligent process to move toward a comprehensive immigration reform. And that's why I support that. But I think Brian raises a very good question, which needs a lot more discussion.
Yeah, my bumper sticker on this, Senator, is we don't have an illegal immigration problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem. And but in any case, that's my bumper sticker. Let's see here. Ann in Lakeland, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Senator, I'm happy to see those large crowds showing up, but we need to get them to vote. If they are not registered a Democrat, they cannot vote in the primary. So all those independents and other parties that want to vote for you need to change their registration to Democrat so they can vote in those closed primaries.
At least in about half the states, Ann. I believe that's the case.
Right.
Senator?
Well, Ann is absolutely right. We have been bringing out large numbers of people, and one of the goals of this campaign, which I call a political revolution, is to substantially increase voter turnout and to get ordinary people to work together to start standing up for our rights. And Ann's right. It's one thing to bring out a large crowd. It's another thing to translate that into power at the polls. So, Ann, I take your advice very seriously, and we are working very, very hard on it. The issue even becomes more complicated when you talk about caucus states like Iowa, where it's not even just coming out to vote. It's participating in the caucus, et cetera. So thank you, Ann. Thanks for your support, and that is an issue we feel very strongly about.
James in Ocala, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, how you doing, Senator? I'm a staunch advocate for you, and I appreciate what you're doing with the unions. I think once immigration is cleared up, unions bring immigrants in and make unions stronger, and I really feel that that's what the Republicans are against. That's why I think they're so against immigration. I just want to know your thoughts on it, and I really thank you.
I think James makes a very good point. I think that is one of the key factors. What Republicans understand is that when you have low voter turnouts, when you have a campaign finance system that allows billionaires like the Koch brothers to buy elections, when you have the ability of states to suppress the votes, they understand that the only strong opposition to their right-wing political agenda of giving more tax breaks to billionaires and cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, etc., the only organized strong opposition is the trade union movement. And that is why in Wisconsin you have Governor Walker there going to war against the unions. That's true in other states as well. They understand that when working people stand together, not only can they negotiate decent wages and working conditions, but they have political power. And when you break unions, you're breaking the political power of working families. And I think James's point is that when you have a lot of low-income working people who are today undocumented, when they get legal status, there is a good chance that many of them will want to join unions and help strengthen the trade union movement in America. And that is absolutely something that the Koch brothers and the Republican Party do not want to see.
Mark in Sanford, Maine. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Senator Sanders. Good to have you come here the other day. It was a huge crowd. Everybody's applauding you and hoping that you're the next FDR here. My question was, Reaganomics, Senator, how it evolved through the years, what Reagan did, the deregulation and everything. And I keep reverting back to what Robert Reich said. We have to change the rules back. But how do we do that? It's going to be overhauling Congress, isn't it?
Mark, the answer is yes. You know, and everything is related to everything else in this sense. Last election, midterm election, 63% of the American people didn't vote. 80% of young people didn't vote. Koch brothers and other people spent huge sums of money Republican states have voter suppression. Under those types of scenarios, the candidates representing the rich and the multinational corporations win elections. What our job is, Mark, is to change that dynamic, to have as large a voter turnout as we can, to pass legislation which makes it easier, not harder, for citizens to vote, to have a real campaign finance system which not only overturns Citizens United but moves us to public funding of elections. And when you have large numbers of people sitting down and thinking about the real issues impacting their lives, they are not going to be voting for the Republicans. They're not going to be voting for people, as was the case in the Republican budget recently passed, that gave $250 billion in tax breaks to the top two-tenths of 1% while making massive cuts in healthcare, education, and nutrition. They're not going to be voting for those people. But once we develop that movement, that is the most important thing, a movement based on progressive principles. Once we start electing people who are prepared to stand up for working families and take on the big money interest, then we make the changes that we need. And in terms of, for example, Wall Street, in my view, it's not only a step forward to reestablish Glass-Steagall and in the deregulation of Wall Street. It is more important that we break up these huge financial institutions that have so much power today. It is vitally important that this nation lead the world in addressing what Pope Francis calls one of the great planetary crises we face, which is climate change. And when working people stand together, you know what? We're going to make public colleges and universities tuition-free. And we're going to work aggressively to substantially lower the student debt that millions of Americans are now struggling with. That's what happens when people stand together.
We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment. It's Thursday. We're live. Feel free to call in if you have a question for the senator. We're doing a bunch with Bernie a day early. It's just, you know, Senator, as you probably figured out, has a rather crazy travel schedule these days.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz, and it's also a great news site. And welcome back. Mark, watching Free Speech TV in Chico, California on the Dish Network. Mark, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Tom and Senator Sanders. Thank you for taking my call. Senator Sanders, how do we go about changing these insane trade policies like NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent relations with China? Does it take Congress to do it, or can a president do it, or what?
Well, a president obviously has enormous impact on how trade policies are implemented, but the president doesn't write the laws. So the most important thing, there are things that a president can do in terms of executive orders and so forth, but the most important thing is to change these trade policies, which have been such a disaster for the middle class and working families. You know, when we talk about the collapse of the American middle class, and when we talk about why people are working longer hours for lower wages, and when we talk about the massive level of income and wealth inequality in America, what we are talking about is some of the results of these disastrous trade policies. So they have got to be changed. And we need trade policies that are fair not only for American workers, but for the workers of countries around the world, often very poor countries. But what we don't need are trade policies which simply enrich the multinational corporations and their CEOs. So that is just, to me, Mark, a very, very important issue, and it's one I will deal with.
Nicole, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Wow, this is really exciting. So basically, I just wanted to ask if you were in support of Senator Warren's and Senator McCain's reinstitution of Glass-Steagall.
Glass-Steagall, yes. The answer is I am. You are looking, well, you're not looking. You are hearing from a senator and a former congressman who helped lead the effort unsuccessful effort, I should say, against deregulation of Wall Street. You know, I was just looking today, actually, at some quotes that I had made when Alan Greenspan testified before the Banking Committee, of which I was a member. And in essence, what I said, Mr. Greenspan, he was then chairman of the Fed, aren't you a little bit concerned that when we have all this concentration of power in Wall Street, that if something goes wrong, the whole system could go down? He said, oh, no, no, nothing to worry about. Well, it turned out, sadly, that I was right and he was wrong. So we have got to re-regulate Wall Street, Nicole, but I think we've got to go further, and that is actually break up these large financial institutions. You have the top six, which have assets of about $10 trillion, which is equivalent to about 60% of the GDP of America. They issue most of the credit cards, most of the mortgages, too much power. I fear very much we could be put into another too-big-to-fail situation, so I think we've got to break them up.
Yeah, you and Byron Dorgan, I guess, in the Senate were the ones who were warning against all this kind of stuff. Yep. It's quite extraordinary. We'll be right back. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around and be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. Doing Brunch with Bernie a day early. Senator Sanders with us live here at Thursday. And, Senator, I wanted to ask you, one of the people who works here says that told me that you were going to be in this neighborhood giving a speech tonight in Virginia. Do I have that right?
That's right. There is a Northern Virginia Democratic function, and I am going to be there. That's right.
Where is that? Do you know?
That is a very good question. I will tell you.
People can go to San.
It's in Arlington.
In Arlington, Virginia.
It's the Northern Virginia Democratic Party. Its location is the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, 4301 Wilson Boulevard in Arlington, Virginia.
Great.
And that's where I'll be tonight.
Okay. Let's see here. Ethan, in Hanover, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I'm a sophomore at Penn State, and I just wanted to say how much you inspire me to bring change to Pennsylvania and the community. My question is, how do you think the public school system needs to change to fit the needs of 21st century America?
Well, first of all, Ethan, thank you very much for your willingness to engage and be thinking about the political process. As I mentioned earlier on this program, I was very distressed that in the last election, 80% of young people didn't vote. You guys are the future of America. You're the idealism of America. You're the energy of America. And if you're not participating in the political process, we have some very, very serious problems. In terms of public education, clearly, we need to make sure that the system is well-funded. We need to make sure that teachers are able to teach to the kids, not for tests. And right now, literally on the floor, is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. I hope that we will kill No Child Left Behind, which I know is enormously unpopular in the state of Vermont, and I suspect all over this country, where teachers are spending huge amounts of time teaching to tests rather than teaching to the kids. I think furthermore, Ethan, we have got to be honest with you, really change our attitude toward education and understand that a well-educated nation is one of the best and most important things that we can do. And we have to put a prize. We have to have a sense of priorities that says good education is what our culture and country should be about. And that includes having a excellent quality pre-K education system. You know, most women are now at work. Husbands are at work. Kids from 0 to 4 need quality childcare, and they need quality pre-K education. And as, you know, I've said throughout the campaign, We're going to fight to make sure that we have tuition-free public colleges and universities in America. And that's important not only for people about to enter college. It's important for every kid in school in the seventh grade or the fifth grade in this country, because they will know that if they do their schoolwork, if they take school seriously, if they do their homework, they will, in fact, be able to go to college. And they don't know that right now because it's not true right now. So opening up college to all people who have the ability and the desire will have a huge impact on improving education in this country, because kids will know that if they study, they can get a higher education and they can make it into the middle class.
Gene in Watseka, Illinois, if I'm saying that right. Gene, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. I have a thought that we should change the Department of Defense to the Department of Development for Humanity and develop solar, thermal, wind for the world and bring humanity up to our standards. Thank you.
Well, I think, thanks, Gene, for your thought. Let me just take your idea and kind of broaden it a little bit. And that is, it is important, it goes without saying, to have a strong national defense. And we can argue about how much money we should spend on defense. But I think what Gene's point is that for the United States to do well internationally, we have got to be a leader in the world in helping those people who are in need. And whether it is the international effort to combat climate change, which is already causing devastating problems in countries like Pakistan, where they've had this terrible heat wave, but all over the world. And what the Defense Department, in fact, and CIA are telling us, that if we don't get a handle on climate change, this is going to cause international conflict in years to come, as people are fighting over scarce amounts of water and land in which to grow their crops. So I think Gene's point is, if I can broaden it a little bit, is that our government should be a leader working with poor people all over the world in improving their lives. And by the way, when we do that, we create allies all over the world. We are really fighting terrorism all over the world when people see us standing with them in their efforts to create a decent life. So I thank Gene very much for that comment.
And Senator, we have about a minute left. You also just introduced legislation on the, you know, on building solar out to, you want to tell us about that, or would you like
sure.
to just wrap up the hour with this?
Well, just a continuation of I think Gene's point. Pope Francis, I think, was extremely brave, and in highlighting in his recent encyclical, what climate change is about, and the need for us to transform our energy system away from fossil fuels to such sustainable energies as solar, wind, geothermal, and others. And obviously, I've been introducing several pieces of legislation trying to expand the utilization of solar. In my state of Vermont, for example, not a great solar state, but good enough. We are putting in a lot of solar panels, and that's true all over the country. In Iowa, in a few years, I think 40% of their electricity will come from wind. And those are the kinds of efforts that we have to make. And I think when we do that, when we lead the world, when we work with China and India and Russia and other countries, when our technology is getting out there, not only do we preserve this planet for our kids and our grandchildren, by the way, we're going to create a lot of decent paying jobs in this country. So that's just an enormous issue that we've got to address.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us this week, and take good care of your health, and good luck tonight in Arlington, Virginia.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you, Senator. Great talk. We'll be back with Anything Goes Summer here on the Tom Hartman Program right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, that's interesting. Timothy in Edgewater, Maryland. It's Anything Goes Summer. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my question was actually for Senator Sanders, but it actually might be better if you answer it, probably. I have some conservative friends on Facebook and other people I'm trying to convince to support Bernie, and a lot of them have a hard time distinguishing what a socialist Democrat is. They seem to think that if you use the word socialist, you're talking about Joseph Stalin. So I was wondering how I can explain that to my friends.
Tell them that Germany calls itself a democratic socialist country. France calls itself a democratic socialist country. All the Scandinavian countries call themselves democratic socialist countries. When he talks about democratic socialism, he's talking about basically, you could argue that it's the European model, but it really was the direction that Franklin Roosevelt was taking us, which is that health care is considered a right, education, including college, is considered a right, and a decent retirement is considered a right, and that, you know, in the context of working conditions, you have some protection from abuse by employers, and that if a person works a 40-hour week, whether they have a high school diploma, whether they're a dropout, or whether they got a PhD, if they work a 40-hour week, they never live in poverty. I mean, these are the basic tenets of it, of democratic socialism.
Yeah, totally understand. I want to, because a lot of the Republican candidates or the clown bus are, you know, use that as a negative, the European model.
Well, they always drop the word democratic too. They always say socialist, and socialism means a whole lot of different things. You know, Karl Marx used that word rather liberally, but he was ultimately talking about communism. The USSR, and most of the people who you get blowback on the word socialist from are people of my generation, people who remember the Soviet Union, and it was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But they weren't socialists, they were communist. And, you know, in communism, what Karl Marx proposed was that because the capitalists had so badly, and keep in mind, Karl Marx was writing back in the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s, or 1850s, 60s, and 70s, I guess it was.
Right.
At that point in time, the big industrialists, because this was the early days, I mean, you know, steam engines and whatnot were kicking off in the 1830s. So this was the early years of the Industrial Revolution, and basically workers had no rights, and industry was growing like crazy. And what Marx pointed out was that the abuses of workers at the hands of the employers, and the workers were desperate. I mean, they needed money, and they, you know, other than being a farmer where you have a relative degree of autonomy, you know, once you leave the farm, if you can't get a job, you're screwed. And so Marx's solution, which is communism, not socialism, was for the government to take away from those capitalists those businesses and run them on, you know, by the people on behalf of the people. Now, it sounds nice in theory, and, you know, a lot of people thought it was a great idea. And over the next 70 years, the Russian Revolution happened, and they actually put it into place in the Soviet Union. They banned, you know, private enterprise, basically. And it didn't work. You know, it works with a small community like a kibbutz. It's been working in Israel for 60 years, but it doesn't work at the level of a nation state. But that's not socialism. That's communism. So, you know, Bernie never in his wildest dreams, to the best of my knowledge, has ever advocated that the state should take over the manufacture of anything, you know, or at least anything that's not part of the commons. I mean, but when you look at the things that we own in common, whether it's our national parks, which the Republicans and the Koch brothers now want to privatize, or whether it's our public schools, which they've been successfully privatizing all over the country over the last three decades, whether it's our water supply, our electric supply, you know, these are all natural monopolies. All of these things really should be in the hands of we the people rather than the hands of somebody whose first goal is to make a buck off us.
Absolutely hear you. Now, if I could just turn that into a five-word meme that people would listen to.
Here's the five-word meme, I guess. Democratic socialism means protecting the rights of workers and making sure that – this is more than five words – and making that people have access – to health care and education throughout their lives to whatever extent they need it and can succeed with it, you know, need it with regard to health care and can succeed with regard to education. I mean, it's really a progressive agenda. And
right, it does. It sounds. I was thinking maybe the other way would just be to just do FDR's Four Freedoms and kind of go, okay.
Well, the better than his Four Freedoms would be his proposed amendments to the Constitution. I'm forgetting what he called that.
I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, this was just a few months before he died. He proposed, four amendments to the Constitution, that everyone would have the right to a job, that everyone would have in other words, the government could be the employer of last resort if capitalism fails, that everyone has a right to religious liberty and freedom from religion as well, that everyone has a right to an education, and I'm forgetting what the fourth one is, but, Harvey Kay is worried about this.
Education and, the freedom from fear, I suppose.
Yeah, freedom. Well, that's the four freedoms. This was a different suggestion. I'm sorry it's not right at the top of my head.
Now, I'll look it up. And one day, Tom, when you have time, I'd love for you to spend some time about his Vice President Wallace and how the world would have been so different if he had been nominated to be the Vice President when FDR died.
Yeah. He called it the Second Bill of Rights.
Second Bill of Rights.
Yeah, education was one piece of it. Yeah, check it out. I'll have to look it up to read it to you. This is one of those things I should have memorized a long time ago, Timothy. I'm sorry I haven't. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Andrew, I don't have a city for you. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm from Los Angeles.
Okay, what's up?
I'm 24 years old. I guess I'm a recovering Republican, and unbeknownst to me until lately, a recovering systematic racist. I wanted to call about the Texas textbooks that are coming out, really whitewashing history.
Yeah, no mention of Jim Crow or the KKK whatsoever. But they do say that Moses influenced our Constitution.
It's ridiculous, and I'm just wondering if there's any policy or anything going on to kind of combat and to get the truth into our textbooks, because in my education, I was pretty oblivious to really how bad it was, actually. And now it's about to get worse for people in Texas and possibly surrounding states.
Yep. This is a tough one because the idea of local communities or even states having some sovereignty with regard to education of their people is one that's very appealing in the United States and is basically built into our Constitution in the form of the 10th Amendment. And every federal effort to improve education, going back to Lyndon Johnson, I think LBJ created the Department of Education. I could be wrong, but the Department of Education, and then No Child Left Behind, which was co-opted and turned into a corporate promotion for testing companies, and now Common Core, which is entirely voluntary, and it's basically just a set of suggestions. I don't know how to do this, frankly. I don't have an easy answer to this. Texas, their school board was taken over basically by Republican bigots, and they rewrote the history of the Civil War to say that it was about states' rights, the war of Northern aggression and all this kind of stuff, and that slavery was only a little piece of it. When slavery is mentioned 18 times in South Carolina's, statement of secession. So, what to do about it? I think, daylight, sunlight, is a pretty good disinfectant. And I think that the history of the Civil War, of slavery, the Civil War, and Reconstruction, and the failure of Reconstruction as a result of a Hayes presidency, those things should all be parts of Common Core, at least suggested. Andrew, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Saturday. Summer. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Paul in Phoenix, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having Bernie on again. And as your last caller or one of your last callers said, it might be best that I reached you instead of Bernie because this involves a recent NPR, National Public Radio, interview with Bernie conducted by David Green, Morning Edition host. And he was... Mr. Green was trying to catch Bernie in one of these silly soundbite hyperbolic things regarding what color of people matter, and invoking Hillary comment that she got caught in one of these Black Lives Matters things. And Bernie was so professional and so respectful, but yet so frustrated. I could tell that he was just clenching his teeth. But I wanted to praise Bernie's attitude in handling that interview, because we all know that even though NPR has drifted to the dark side, if you will, over the last several years, they are still somewhat the country's news, broadcaster, if you will. And Bernie, again, he just ended up at the end. He was so frustrated. He just said, well, that's a silly argument. All lives matter. And Bernie was trying to bring in to discussion, employment, economic disparity, things like that, perhaps multi-generational racism and things like that. But yet Mr. Green wanted him to say, do you think Black Lives Matter? He wanted that little sound bite. And again, to Bernie's credit, he just wasn't going to tolerate it. But I know you commented in the past about NPR, and you've noticed their drift, if you will. But my point being, please, to your listeners, when you hear something off color or inappropriate, send a respectful letter to NPR. I did that, and I got a respectful response back. In fact, they have an ombudsman that handles these coverage issues of primary candidates, lesser than, if you will, primary candidates. And it's up to us to inform NPR when they're not doing things fairly.
Yeah. Sadly, virtually all of our media these days, I would say, with the exception of Free Speech TV, because they're so profit-driven, and profit is a function of ratings, they're so ratings-driven that they're far more interested in gotcha comments that can go viral or somebody making a fool of themselves than they are in actually talking about the real issues or the truth.
It was so apparent and so obvious. I was embarrassed for the interviewer. I was embarrassed for Bernie, and yet, again, he handled it so well, because he can't afford to diss NPR, if you will, not in Bernie's nature anyway. He just doesn't say negative things.
Yeah.
He's always positive, looking forward, and that's why I love the man. And I might add, you as well, for bringing him to us every week.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much.
Nobody.
Appreciate
Bye.
The call. I got to say, when I was a kid growing up, I can remember my father saying this, literally thousands of times. Whenever I would complain about anybody or say anything disparaging about anybody, whether it was a family member or somebody else, my dad always said, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. And he literally lived by that. My father lived until he was in his early 70s, and I was there for, 50 years of it. And I have no memory of my father ever criticizing anybody other than a few politicians. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And dare to say, no, not a chance. Don't even think about it. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, how you doing?
Fine, Tom. I was just calling because you were having a conversation with a young man just earlier who asked about if there's a simple way of describing democratic socialism.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I would like to say, number one, that we are in a momentous moment of our country's history, because Senator Sanders represents the very first democratic socialist candidate, openly democratic socialist candidate since the 1930s, really, to be receiving this level of popular support, not since the days of Norman Thomas. So we are at a truly momentous point in our history to be enjoying the fact that a democratic socialist candidate is able to campaign like this and receive this level of support. What I would like to say is, I'm a democratic socialist myself, been so since the age of 19. And my definition of democratic socialism is this. Democratic socialism is a genuinely pro-democracy interpretation of Karl Marx's original ideas. Basically, between the years 1919 and 1920, a major crisis occurred in the worldwide socialist movement back then, where socialists in Europe, Western Europe and North America, began to notice that something had gone seriously wrong with the Russian Revolution. that it had degenerated into an outright dictatorship. And socialists around the world began to say to themselves, this isn't what socialism is about. It's not what we originally intended it to be. And so we need to break away from these Bolsheviks. You know, they've degenerated, and they are not who we are. And so we need to redefine socialism along a more genuinely democratic ideology. And by 1920, what resulted was that a totally separate worldwide organization known as the Socialist International had been organized, which still exists today. And basically, democratic socialism, as I say, is the red flag, but with a big blue streak on its side, meaning we interpret socialism strictly along the lines of democracy. And so, for example, we do not believe in government ownership, nor do we believe in private ownership. We believe that the workers themselves, the working class, should be the ones in control and in governance of the major commanding heights of our economy. So democratic socialism, as you said, fights for workers' rights. It fights for government involvement in social services to ensure an education and health care and housing and food and nutrition for everybody on an equal basis. It fights for against income inequality. And so we take Karl Marx's ideas, and we believe that we are interpreting them and applying them in a genuinely democratic way, which did not occur with Bolshevism. And in fact, when communism collapsed pretty much around the world, we're still going strong. I mean, we democratic socialists saw all of that happening, and it's like we're looking at a totally different universe collapsing. And it didn't affect us at all, because essentially democratic socialism is not communism, but it's not capitalism either. We believe that it is genuine economic and social democracy. And let me just say that if you go to the Socialist International website, they use the word progressive a lot, which means that there's a lot of interchangeability between the progressive left and democratic socialism. We're practically first cousins, so that's why we get along so well, and that is why Bernard Sanders is getting so much progressive support. All right, Tom, take care.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alberto. Rich in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, I'm sorry, Miss Bernie. Hey, I heard Bernie talking about the farm worker bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when they tried to pass it last time under George W. Bush, they had a provision in there to where once they got here and they were working on a farm or something, they were allowed to apply for any job, not just a farm job. So I'm just...
I don't think that's a provision of... Yeah, maybe you're thinking of the old Bracero program, although I think the Bracero program, which was in the 50s and 60s, was limited to agriculture, you know, to basically picking.
I called in to someone on NPR, and I asked him about it, and they said, well, in theory, yes, I guess they could apply for any job once they were here. And I said, well, you know, that's an out for them to give away more factory jobs. And
is there a guest worker farm bill? Farm legislation, or is this a proposed legislation? I don't know what you're talking about.
No, it's proposed legislation. They were talking about a proposed farm worker bill.
Right. See, we tried that, Rich. We tried that back in the 50s and 60s, and it was called the Bracero program, and it was badly abused, because what happened was when people came in from Mexico, they would be put into a registry, essentially, and they would be given a card that, you know, it's essentially a green card, you know, only it was a green card that was limited to one industry, agriculture. And the problem was that if the employer said, this person is not worthy of being in this country working here, or if they were not able to find employment, they lost their Bracero status and they had to go back to Mexico. And so the employers would basically say, if you don't do what I say, if you don't work a 12-hour day and let me pay you for an 8-hour day, I'm gonna make sure that you lose your Bracero status. And it was well documented how widely and viciously this program was abused, and it became a national embarrassment, and they pulled the thing. And I'm not sure what year, but I think it was in the early 60s. Might have been before that. And so any guest worker program that is specific to one particular industry is going to be subject to those same kind of abuses.
Yeah. Can I also tell you about a new Bernie supporter?
Quickly.
Yeah, I heard a radio host talking that, you know, oh, Bernie doesn't have a chance. And I called into him. I asked him, I said, please don't say that anymore, because they did that to Perot, Howard Dean.
They did that to Barack Obama. Yeah. I had the number two guy in the Democratic Party in California, who was an African-American, on this show back when it was Hillary versus Obama, saying, I'm voting for Hillary because there's no way America is going to elect a black man whose middle name is Muhammad. And he was an African-American. I mean, they said that about Obama. So, yeah, I'm with you, Rich.
He's now a Bernie supporter, so give Bradley J. a good plug. And...
Okay, you got
You're
it.
You're listening to Thanks the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Here on the Tom Hartman Program, talk media for the sane among us. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan in Hanson, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Dan. What's up?
Hi. I just wanted to talk about how everybody in the mainstream has really been ignoring Bernie's civil rights record. They'll say that he has no support from minorities, but that's all they'll say. They'll say he's going to lose because he doesn't have any support for minorities, and then they won't talk about why they should really support him. Aside from maybe Ed Schultz, no one on TV will talk about that.
Well, he was on Al Sharpton's show the other day, and Al Sharpton pointed out
Bernie
had been there from day one. He got arrested in the early 60s trying to integrate the University of Chicago housing.
I know he actually has the record for it, but
yeah.
Somebody on Chris Massey's show, he was talking about, he just completely dismissed it. He said it's 91-3%, he has no chance, and nobody ever talks about his record. And except for, like, what, two or three people on MSNBC?
Right.
Every other major news network never talks about it. Even, like, NPR or CNN, all those places, they don't talk about it.
You're right. Well, they don't talk about most of the issues. They don't talk about Bernie's record on trade. They don't talk about his record on the war. You know, back in 1991, he was warning us that we shouldn't be invading Iraq for the first Gulf War, because it would lead to future wars in Iraq. I mean, he has been right on so many things, and they just, you know, they're not going to cover the issues because our media no longer talks about issues. Our media talks about whatever will get the most ratings, and that is whoever's the most outrageous, which is why Donald Trump is, you know, they're all in love with Donald Trump right now, because he gets them ratings.
I think he's playing his campaign perfectly, though, because he's spending a lot of money on online.
He being Bernie?
Yeah, Bernie.
Yeah.
He's spending a ton of money on, like, Twitter ads and stuff, and I think that's where he's going to reach more people like that than the, like, news he'll get on TV.
At least more people who are under 50 years old.
For him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that the people who are over 50 years old have enough of a memory of what America was like before Reaganomics and Reaganism destroyed this country that they're with Bernie, too, because they just, you know, they know where he is on the issues.
I think if he could, like, I mean, I have no faith in people of my age. I'm only 16, and I don't think many kids who actually can vote will vote, like, 24 to 18. But most young kids also agree with them, just talking around to people. Like, lots of people's minds are changing about this stuff, even in the younger generation.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that Bernie is explicitly talking about that is, you know, I think very appealing to people under 25 is that every public college in the United States, it'd be all your community colleges and all your state universities, should be free,
yeah.
Period. End of discussion. They should be free, just like the University of California was before Ronald Reagan became governor. It was totally free or you know, super, like $5 a semester in some places, depending on the campus and the class and things. But it was pretty much free to go to school in California for decades.
Yeah, and, I mean, over the last 20 years, everything's been artificially inflated, especially college.
Oh yeah, and one of the largest reasons for that is this proliferation of for-profit colleges that are just scams.
Yeah. Well, I hope Bernie can. I hope he wins.
For
my sake, I guess.
Yeah, and Bernie's also talking about unemployment, which is badly affecting people under 25. I'm with you, Dan. I'm with you. Tell all your friends. Pass it along as much as you can. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Oh, Tom, yeah, you're going to hear from me a lot until this election is over. Then I won't bother you anymore.
And once a week, Corky, that's all we ask.
I got an idea for Bernie. I need your help, your audience. I want to start, you know how he complained about young kids not voting? We can get him involved. You know what a flash mob is?
Yeah.
Right? Well, I want to do a flash road rally.
How do you do that?
I want to start in Wisconsin. I need people to start me from California and bring them to Wisconsin. Then I'll escort the train to Vermont. I'm going to paint on my car, Bernie, 2016. I got a white Cadillac, so it's a 99. I can afford to mess it up.
Okay.
And I want to see how many people, young kids are into flash mobs.
Yeah, although generally, you know, they do a flash mob because they're following whoever it is who's tweeting out, you know, be here at a particular point. And that may not be you, Corky.
Well,
no
I
offense.
Will be in Wisconsin. I'll carry the caravan from Wisconsin to Vermont.
But you need to get some young folks who've got a lot of followers, you know, who do these kind of things involved in that.
Your audience. I also need some experts on insurances because I do not want to be uninsured. So if you could use your audience participation to find a lawyer who can determine what the price would be to insure a road rally from California to Vermont.
Well, Corky, I'm going to have to toss that back at you. I can't be your surrogate here on the air. I'm sorry.
No, just if you could just collect some numbers or something. Somebody calls in, leaves you their telephone
number. If somebody listening right now wants to call in and offer advice, Corky listens. So, Corky, I wish you the best with this. I think it's a great idea, and I hope you can make something like that happen. Keep us up to date. Thank you. Michelle in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to talk briefly for a minute about foreign aid and the importance of maintaining that part of the budget. I'm sure not many viewers or listeners are aware of the ways in which foreign aid actually benefits the United States, obviously helping bring countries out of poverty, increases the number of people who are buying U.S. exports. And so it's actually a very important part of the U.S. economic development that we support foreign aid. But I also wanted to call attention to the Food for Peace Reform Act. Currently, U.S. food aid has a lot of regulations that make it inefficient and cost ineffective. And the Food for Peace Reform Act would get rid of those in order to help provide food aid for millions more people per year, while also, making better use of U.S. taxpayer money. And I guess I wanted to call attention to that to your listeners and maybe get your thoughts on that.
Foreign aid, I mean, this is, I'm a little confused here, Michelle. You're suggesting, Bernie was, maybe it wasn't Bernie, but we recently talked about using foreign aid. I'm pretty sure it was Bernie, actually. It was talking about using foreign aid as a way of getting friends rather than enemies, rather than dropping bombs on people, help them rebuild their societies. But what did I miss about what you were saying there, your question?
I guess I just wanted to know your thoughts on foreign aid in general, possibly maybe the Food for Peace Reform Act, which would kind of deregulate foreign aid and allow it to be more effective in order to help, millions more people who are suffering from poverty around the world.
Right. Most foreign aid, most countries' foreign aid policies are very intentional and designed to meet the foreign policy objectives or domestic policy objectives, for that matter, of the country offering the foreign aid. For example, for many decades, and I don't know if this is still the case, but I know it was as of 6 or 8 years ago, Japan would only give foreign aid to countries that used that money to buy Japanese goods. And so basically what they were doing was the government was subsidizing imports, or exports, excuse me. We have a program called the Import-Export Bank that does the same thing. It loans money to foreign governments, but only if they're going to use that money to buy goods made in the United States. The principal beneficiary, that's Boeing, you know, which is a unionized company, and that's one of the reasons why the Republicans are hysterical about it and they're trying to destroy the Import-Export Bank. But there's other 60 other countries that have something like that. Our foreign aid policy has been a hodgepodge over the years. We've offered foreign aid to countries that oppose communism back during the Cold War, regardless of who got it, you know, whether it was some tinhorn dictator or tyrant or despot or whatever. We used foreign aid to get the Israelis and the Egyptians to talk to each other. Jimmy Carter brokered that, and the deal was basically, we'll give you each $3 billion a year forever if you guys just, you know, declare peace. And so they declared peace. We have used foreign aid in a wide variety of ways, both as a carrot and as a stick. I think personally the most effective foreign aid, rather than trying to lift people out of poverty, I think that's the job of the government itself. And I say that as somebody who, since 1978, has worked with, to this day, a non-governmental organization based out of Germany called Salem International. The website is saleminternational.org. And I've helped set up international relief programs in several African countries, in India, in Australia, in Southeast Asia, in South America, in Central America, and in the United States. And I see in many cases just throwing money or bringing food in, if you don't change the fundamental infrastructure, if you don't help institute democratic reforms, it just postpones the inevitable. It can arguably even make things worse. So I think that our foreign aid needs to be as real and as important as our military, and it needs to be directed toward, for example, building schools for girls in countries where women are marginalized, human rights, you know, elevating human rights, and supporting those countries that could go viral with positive things rather than supporting despots and dictators. I mean, we're still sending foreign aid money to Egypt, for example. And, you know, so, Michelle, thank you for the call. I'm not sure I gave you the answer that you want, but thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Summer. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Benjamin, listening on KPFK in Laguna Niguel, California. Hey, Benjamin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, upon first glance, it looks like the Trans-Pacific Partnership has about 12 countries, but it looks like they're kind of, you know, police, some in South America, some in Asia. It looks like kind of desperately random. How do you can explain how those countries got into the partnership? I think there's about 12 of them or so.
Yeah. You know, it started out as the TPSEP, or the P4, this was back in 2006. It was Brunei, Chile, Singapore, and New Zealand. And then in 2008, they brought in Australia, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, Peru, the U.S., and Vietnam. So we've got 12 countries. These are all countries that have the Pacific Ocean as a substantial, you know, chunk of their country. And the idea is, you know, and then let's see here. I'm looking at the wiki page, which is always dangerous because the Wikipedia has been so heavily edited by corporate interests that you tend to get, you know, the corporate point of view and not the opposition. Or if you do get the opposition, it's almost cartoonish. But I frankly don't know how they were picked or why. The history of this, I'm sorry, I can't give you a good answer to that beyond, you know, just that list of countries. What I do know is that for the United States to get into a deal with countries that includes like Malaysia, where slavery is legal, or some of these other countries, where, you know, Vietnam, where trade unions are illegal. There's only one. It's owned by the Communist Party of Vietnam. The minimum wage is 52 cents an hour. For us to get into that kind of a deal and just say, okay, all trade barriers are gone. It's, you know, Vietnam becomes essentially, or Malaysia becomes essentially, you know, another state in the United States, you know, functionally part of the United States in terms of trade from the point of view of the corporations. You can't, people can't move, but goods can move and money can move without being encumbered. That seems to me like, you know, just a bad idea. Am I making sense, Benjamin?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was based on those 12, that kind of seemed like they were invited or they weren't, or however they got them there. Would it be safe to say that maybe these 12 partnered together with the United States could take on a superpower like China or Russia in order for us to, you know, enhance our own trade policies?
Well, that's the way that it's being sold. But there's already talk about once this, you know, the TPP allows itself to be expanded, and it can be expanded now. You know, once it passes, it can be expanded without the legislature of the United States approving of it. And there's already conversation about China joining the TPP once it passes. So then it becomes, you know, just, you know, another variation on NAFTA and CAFTA. And I would submit to you that I think that that's probably inevitable that China would join. And China's economy is, you know, fit to surpass ours if they don't collapse as a result of the stock market crash that's going on there right now. So in my opinion, every country in the world should be developing a trade policy that works best for that country. Protectionism actually works. It has historically. By and large, I'm so opposed to this. Benjamin, thanks for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and free-don.org. And with us is the author of Sideswiped, the true story of what's going on in Washington, D.C., Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
So starting with Iran, I was hoping that a deal would be announced a half hour ago or so, and instead Secretary Kerry said, well, you know, we're still working on it.
Well, you know, you talk about the unreliability of Wiki. I put out a statement there was going to be a deal because from Vienna it came out there to me that there was a deal within hours, and it was extremely reliable sources with NIAC. So something happened, and but you know, obviously – Secretary of State Kerry didn't say there isn't a deal, but they're all tired and starting to yell at each other, et cetera, but it's going to take a few more days. So I think there's going to be a deal, but there was a great false alarm today and a lot of hope that that would be out there. Now, the Republicans will obviously utilize that to say, you see, there's no deal. One minute, the Republicans don't want a deal at all. The next minute, they're complaining about a deal they haven't seen. And then Senator Corker says, we'll take your time, because he wants more time. Senator Corker does. He wants that 60 days to try to sabotage, you know, any deal that's brought forward, which I doubt they can do.
Right.
So I still think there's going to be a deal, but I do apologize. There was quite a false alarm.
Okay. So what else is up?
Okay. Well, of course, the issue of South Carolina, which is amazing. All these years later, now the flag is coming down. The votes were out there. It was a very emotional floor debate, especially with the one representative. I think there were 68 some proposed amendments
right. In
the House, which is amazing.
Most of them from this one guy, Mr. Representative Pike.
Right. And I mean, I can see if somebody, you know, at the end of the day, I don't understand it or agree, but if they have one or two amendments, but 68, what on earth could you do? What would be the purpose of 68 amendments?
To sabotage the deal.
Of course.
I mean.
And so there was a lot of speeches and talks, emotional, to stop that, and now that's done. The interesting story, and this just seriously, Tom, is becoming the political story of the day, at least on the Republican side, but now the head of the Republican National Committee, Priebus, had a 45-minute phone call with Donald Trump, in which he urged, begged, tried to coerce anything he could do to get Donald Trump to, quote, turn it down, lower.
Did you see Trump's tweet on that this morning?
Trump had a tweet. Now, I think the leak came from the RNC, but
yeah, it did. But then Trump tweeted out that the meeting was only 10 minutes long and that Rince Priebus said, hey, you've really hit a nerve. You're doing a great job. Keep it up.
Right. So two different versions. And then Trump had tweeted something to the effect, well, Jeb Bush has to support illegals because his wife's Mexican. He retweeted somebody's tweet
to that effect, yes.
Right, to that effect. So it was came out of his tweet, and then he took it off. But the one point I wanted to make, because now Karl Rove has entered this picture, there is a secondary reason people believe that Priebus made that phone call, and it's this. The backroom deals, the Karl Roves of the world who, you know, have their own candidate, or the big money people, whether it's the Koch brothers with Walker or Karl Rove with Jeb Bush, it's not the issue of immigration. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. It is the issue that the money brokers are going to have to spend more money because Donald Trump has numbers. If Donald Trump's numbers weren't growing, the money people wouldn't even pay attention to him. They wouldn't even call Donald Trump. And so that's what's really behind this, is the fact that Donald Trump is really stepping all over their parade because they have backed candidates and spent a lot of money, and all of a sudden along comes Donald Trump. Mm. I think it's a really fascinating internal battle within the Republican Party. Now, Karl Rove's getting into it, warning that Trump can be the next Todd Akin with a statement on rape, and that's coming from Karl Rove, not so much concern, obviously, of immigration, but a concern about Karl Rove's candidate who's in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Being Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to...
Do you really think Jeb Bush is in trouble? I mean, we're 14, 16 months out.
I really do. I think he's got a problem, and I think it's going to get worse, and he's going to get weaker, and people are going to get closer to him. Now, that's not to say that Donald Trump carries this all through the campaign, but I still think there's a possibility of the real truth coming out from the Republicans, which is they don't want Jeb Bush. They really don't. He's got some name ID, but they know that he is probably one of the weaker candidates. I mean, you can pick some really weak candidates against Hillary Clinton,
right.
You know, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, which would be, you know, Ted Cruz, et cetera. But Jeb Bush would definitely be a weak candidate.
I think the guy to watch is Scott Walker. I think he's the reincarnation of Richard Nixon. From the days that he and his campaign were cheating when he was in college, you know, when the local newspaper endorsed his opponent, his campaign was sending people around to steal the newspapers and trash them. And, you know, shortly after that, he left college without graduating. He's been cheating at politics from day one, and then he tries to do away with the sunshine laws so that people can, you know, sue their government to see the kind of cheating that he's doing. And he got caught on that a couple days ago. But he is so Nixon-esque that you can see why the Koch brothers would be willing to throw, you know, millions and millions of dollars at him, billions of dollars.
And they are. The Koch brothers are behind him. So that's what's behind this whole Donald Trump. I don't think it's all just period of a concern about immigration. I think it's because he's really costing a lot more money, even though these...
I have noticed that Donald Trump has not once mentioned Scott Walker. Have you heard him mention Scott Walker?
I have not heard him mention Scott Walker. And what's amazing is to hear all the Republicans mention Donald Trump.
Right, but Trump is a billionaire, and he hangs out with other billionaires. And Scott Walker is the billionaire's guy. And so my guess, you know, reading the tea leaves and whatnot, is that they have said to Trump, you know, feel free to beat up on anybody you want except Scott Walker, because he's going to be the nominee.
I think it's a great observation. I think there's a lot more behind all of this, Tom, than meets the eye, and I think it's to get rid of Jeb Bush.
Yeah, and it all has to do with the oligarchy. I think that they've concluded that Jeb Bush is not willing to do everything that they want done, whereas Scott Walker, you know, destroy labor, for example, whereas Scott Walker has demonstrated that he's willing to do that. Bob Ney, Congressman, thank you for being with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I believe that Dr. Lonnie Randolph is going to be calling in. Or are we supposed to call him? No, he says he will call directly. Okay, so when he calls in, let me know, because he was supposed to be here right now. Meanwhile, Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Tom, do you personally believe that a computer which is manufactured in China and cost $1,000, that exact same computer manufactured in the United States with union help, which would sell if it cost $1,300?
Probably not. I mean, this is the problem, is American consumers are really squeezed. The American middle class has been crushed by 35 years of Reaganomics. And so, you know, people are actually shopping, you know, on budgets. And that's the problem. And you know, you have to do this as an entire country. You can't just do it in one sector or in one city. You have to do this as an entire country. So if we were simply to say, you know, all Chinese computers, when they hit the border, when they come in through California, they immediately get hit with a $300 tax, a tariff, a 30% tariff. And so now they cost $1,300. And by the way, we can manufacture one in the United States with the union labor for $1,300. Then you would see computer manufacturers starting to set up manufacturing plants in the United States, because then they don't have to pay the shipping all the way from China. And besides that, the cost is going to be the same. This is why it's the rules of the game that matter, Tom. It's not the individual behavior of consumers. It's why I don't advocate boycotts. I advocate taking control of legislative bodies that can reestablish the rules of the game. Am I making sense here?
Yes, and you make perfect sense, because I believe what you just said could work to bring manufacturing back from China to the United States. And I also mentioned Japan, South Korea, too, because those people...
And Taiwan.
They're eating our lunch.
Yeah, and not only could it work, it did work. This was the proposal of Alexander Hamilton in 1791. It was adopted by George Washington in Congress in 1793, and it stood until the Reagan presidency. When we got permanent normal trade relations with China during the Reagan presidency, and then, shortly thereafter during the Clinton presidency, we got NAFTA and the WTO. And then, under, I think it was George W. Bush, did CAFTA. And the Peruvian trade deal, every single one of these things has cost us jobs, because they all involve dropping tariffs. And it's crazy. It's crazy. And we say, oh, well, we'll drop tariffs, they'll drop tariffs, and they'll buy more of our stuff. Well, I'm sorry. These are poor countries. They're not going to buy more of our stuff. And unless it's raw materials to manufacture things to send back to us. China, we are the world's largest exporter now of raw materials. China buys our trees, they buy our lumber, and they buy our iron ore, and they buy our coal. And they use the coal to smelt the iron ore, and they use the trees to make cardboard, and they turn it into computers that in cardboard boxes that they ship back to us. So we're sending them the raw materials, they're sending us the finished goods, and then they take all the money for all the labor. And, we have created tens of millions of jobs in the United States in the last 30 years with these trade policies. The problem is that all those jobs have been overseas. They've been in China and Vietnam and Taiwan and South Korea and Japan. And it's absolutely an insane trade policy, and we need to go back to what the founders of this country understood and put into place and held in place, and Lincoln kept it in place, and Teddy Roosevelt kept it in place, and Franklin Roosevelt kept it in place, and Dwight Eisenhower kept it in place, and John Kennedy kept it in place. And it wasn't until Nixon actually started the dismantling of it when he went to China. But then, and it may be that permanent normal trade relations with China happened under Nixon, but I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was Reagan. Go ahead, Tom.
If there never, ever was an opening to China, let's say Nixon and Ford and Carter and Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush and Obama never went to China, mm-hmm. and China was left to his own devices, would they have by this time imploded?
I don't think they would have imploded. I think they just would have been the way they were in 1986 when I lived in China for a month, basically a third world country. Or they would have developed a domestic industry that would have generated a domestic middle class that would have generated domestic demand. I mean, keep in mind, trade, you know, historically with the for the United States, trade has been less than 3% of our GDP. It's been a very small part of our GDP. Now it's a very large part of our GDP because we're buying all this stuff. I mean, $11 trillion we're in debt now to other countries because we buy their stuff and we sell them to ourselves. And it's just wrong. Tom, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for raising a really important issue. The flag has come down, or will come down, apparently 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, I guess it is, in South Carolina. The Confederate, it's not even the Confederate flag, actually. The original Confederate flag was a white flag with the stars and bars up in the little corner. But this is the fighting flag, the battle flag that Robert E. Lee used, that the Northern Virginia Regiment used. And I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the woman who did this on the clip here, Jim. I'm going to find her name while we play her clip. She is a state representative in the state of South Carolina, and she gave this impassioned speech last night. Here's clip number one.
I attended the funeral of Senator Clemente Pinckney, and the people of Charleston deserve immediate and swift removal of that flag from this grounds. We can say for another day where this flag needs to go, which flag needs to fly, or where it needs to fly, or what museum it needs to be in. But the immediate I'm concerned as a member of the Charleston delegation and speaking on behalf of the people in Charleston, this flag offends my friend Mia McLeod, my friend John King, my friend Reverend Neal. I cannot believe that we do not have the heart in this body to do something meaningful, such as take a symbol of hate off these grounds on Friday.
That is State Representative Jenny Horn of South Carolina. This is probably the speech that pushed it over the top. Here is her responding to the question of, but wait a minute, it's my heritage. Here's Jenny Horn.
I'm sorry. I have heard enough about heritage. I have a heritage. I am a lifelong South Carolinian. I am a descendant of Jefferson Davis. Okay? But that does not matter. It's not about Jenny Horn. It's about the people of South Carolina who have demanded that this symbol of hate come off of the State House grounds. And I will tell you, I do know, and I have it on good authority, that the world is watching this debate.
And the vote was 94 to 20 in the House of Representatives, exceeding the two-thirds limit, and the flag will come down at 10 o'clock Friday morning. And it's the beginning, I think, of, I was going to say the beginning of the end of some of the power of the white supremacist movement. We'll see. We'll see where this goes. But it's a good first step.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And there's so much farther to go. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Alan watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Listen, Tom, I'd like to point out some major design flaws in the book, The Bell Curve by Murray.
Charles
and
Murray.
Hirsty.
Yeah.
Yes. And maybe you could set it up for us, because I think you...
Sure. Yeah. About a decade or so ago, maybe you know the year of publication.
1994.
Oh, okay. So a little more than 21 years ago. Charles Murray and his writing partner, you can tell us his name?
Herstein.
Okay. Wrote this book called The Bell Curve, in which they asserted basically that different races had a different intellectual mean, an intellectual average. that you would find, of course, in a bell curve, you would find very, very smart people in all races and very, very dumb people in all races. But on average, that they argued, black people were less intelligent than white people by a couple of points. And it created quite a furor, and the white supremacy movement to this day loves it. And I've been astonished by the number of Republican candidates who have talked about Charles Murray as being an advisor or a friend. I mean, Mike Huckabee was the first in my recollection, but I've heard several others cite him. Back to you, Alan.
Yes, well, Jeb Bush actually cited it.
You're right.
I think in May.
Yep.
And George Bush cited it when he, I think maybe in his last campaign, he cited that, you know, well, poor people, you know, are poor for a reason. They don't work. You know, it's
right.
But anyway, I'm going to point out the design flaw. I'm not going to even go into the author's intent or anything. But if you look at the bell curve, if you're looking at the design of the experiment, and I'll get to the point quickly, they say that, you know, white poor people do better than black poor people,
right,
that they're more intelligent. And they use all these stats and things to point that out. But they don't really look at the they don't really consider a lot of important things that are extremely important. Okay, for one thing, what can affect someone's IQ? Okay, if you really read the research, stress can affect it. Okay, black women are particularly stressed by negative news.
And by racism in this country.
Of course, of course. And there's some brilliant black people in this country, and even the affirmative action, all that, I don't think it's necessary. If we get down the road and we have kind of a meritocracy, I don't think affirmative action will be necessary. I really don't. I just don't think it will be. Anyway, women experience relationship losses. Their stress is much greater than men's when they experience relationship losses. Men, however, experience performance stress much more acutely than women do. And I think that's the key to the argument of why the bell curve is not correct. You remember Patrick Moynihan, and back in the 60s when he wrote about the black family being disintegrated, and that was one of the reasons that he favored the black family staying together, and that was essential for the
right,
basically for the black family to thrive.
Right.
Well, if you look at what's going on now, I have to go to the next hour, Tom, of course.
Yeah, no, we're out of time, Alan. Alan, thanks for raising the topic.
It's too important, Tom, too important.
Yeah, I agree. It is very important. Feel free to call back next week, and we'll talk about it some more. Alan, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Dr. Lonnie Randolph is on the line with us. He's the president of the South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP. SCNAACP.org, I believe, is the website. Do I have that right, Dr. Randolph?
You are absolutely correct.
Okay. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so very much for allowing us an opportunity to be on your program.
Thank you. We played a clip, we played two clips, actually, in the last segment of, or maybe it was at the end of the last hour, of Jenny Horn, State Representative Jenny Horn, giving an impassioned speech last night, which I think played a consequential role in getting this South Carolina flag taken down. What are your thoughts on this whole event and what's going on?
Well, it's I'm happy, of course, that it is over, but because we have so many issues in South Carolina, human issues and people issues and school issues and healthcare issues, I tell the members of our organization, last night, 12:30, 12:45, whatever time it was, may have even been 1:15, those that I was communicating with, I told them, celebrate tonight, because come tomorrow morning, we will start our efforts to ensure that the next 490 days that we concentrate on voter participation, voter registration, voter education, and the get out to vote.
Yeah.
58 to 68% of African Americans voting
is criminal to me. So if we are to make headway in this country, we're stressing the things that we depend upon legislators to do, but we need to take control of the lives of people ourselves. So we will start our effort today. In fact, it has already started.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
The celebration is over. That's over with. Well, not quite. At 4 o'clock today, this will be over because the governor will sign the new law.
Right, and at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, the flag will come down. But this is just the beginning. So what's next, sir?
Well, as I stated, there are so many issues that we have to deal with still of race and race-based. Now, those who disagree and say that there are other issues, that other reasons why people are not doing well are struggling in South Carolina. People struggle everywhere in America, but I don't know of anywhere else in this country where the children in 38 school districts in the state of South Carolina are suffering the so-called corridor of shame that exists in the state, where the state just refuses to adequately fund education for young people in those so-called needy school districts.
These are largely black districts?
Of course they are. Now, right. You know there are no white districts that are being punished.
Yeah.
It never was a law in South Carolina for white children to not be educated, but it was for people who look like I do.
Yeah.
So this is, race is still, with all the so-called progress that we think we've made, we really haven't made that much progress. Things are not a lot different today than they were 50 years ago. We just celebrated, or they just celebrated, I didn't celebrate it, the 150th anniversary of the ending of the Civil War.
Right.
Why in the world are we celebrating the sesquicentennial of destroying the lives of people? I just don't get it. There are too many good things for us to talk about and to work on together in a unified fashion, but we still have a lot of separation, and the zip code determines so many things that it shouldn't determine.
Yep.
And I'm not satisfied. Even in my old age, I consider myself an old athlete, and I have an athlete's attitude about things that we take on. My high school track coach's name was Dean Fievel, greatest coach in the world. I was 5'4" and weighed 120 pounds, and he had me crazy enough to think that I could run through a wall.
Wow.
But a good coach will do that, but they not only just coach you, they teach you about life. So a lot of my life skills came from athletics. And that is the only area in this country where we have really made any substantial progress.
So what are the specifics? We're talking with Dr. Lonnie Randolph of the NAACP of South Carolina. What do we do next? What can the people who are listening or watching this program right now, in the roughly 2 minutes I think we have left until we hit a break, what can they do?
Well, number one, I hope that all citizens register to vote.
Mm.
That's the first thing, because there is very little accountability in government, and then lobbyists shouldn't be writing and determining what issues they support and they vote on.
Yeah.
And the money, I mean, it's just frightening to think that in the last election that $6 billion was spent on the election, $1 billion by each candidate, and then the strange money, $4 billion.
Right, and it's probably going to double this next 14 months.
That's depressing.
Yeah.
But the only thing that can defeat that voting in record numbers, and 68%, which is approximately how we voted nationally in this country last election cycle. Well, not the last election cycle. We didn't do that in 2014,
right.
But we did do that in 2012.
Right.
But that's not enough. We have to have a better than 90% turnout in order for us to make a difference in helping the lives of other people.
So the big work right now is getting those very voters that the Republicans are trying to suppress the vote of, people of color, the poor, the young, the elderly, to be registered to vote and make sure that they either get to the polls or get an absentee ballot so that they can and do vote.
Listen, you sounded like an opera singer. You did a great job in saying that that's exactly what we are planning, and that's what we're working on. We've already started today. I just don't think that we are at a point in our life and in history that we can actually rest.
Yeah.
There is no rest. Let's do something good for the next generation and keep them the right way.
I absolutely agree. Dr. Lonnie Randolph, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so very much for giving me an opportunity to be on
You're
your program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Hang on just
a
second.
202-536-2370.
It has been an honor, Dr. Randolph, and snnaacp.org. Thank you, sir. Slightly unbalanced, Tom Hartman here with you. The Florida Supreme Court has ruled today that the, well, let me give you a little backstory here. Back in 2010, there was a ballot initiative. This was pushed by the League of Women Voters and others that said that it was an amendment to the Constitution, the Florida State Constitution, that said that it was unconstitutional for lawmakers to draw congressional districts in a way that disenfranchised people based on race or on party or whatever. In other words, no more gerrymandering in Florida. The Republicans went ahead in 2010 based on the 2010 census. Every according to the Constitution, every year that ends with a zero, in other words, every 10 years, there's a census taken. And then in the following year or two, the individual states, based on that census, redraw their congressional districts so that every member of Congress represents roughly the same number of people. And right now it's around, I think it's 630,000 people, basically, that every member of Congress represents in the United States. It was originally, it was 38,000 back in the day, as I recall. It's been a while since I've seen the actual numbers, but it was in those neighborhoods. And right now, Florida, and here's the interesting thing, Florida has 4.6 million registered Democrats and 4.2 million registered Republicans. So you would think that there would be more Democratic members of the Florida legislature. You would think that there would be a Democrat who is the governor of Florida. And you would think that there would be more members going to Congress from Florida to the U.S. House of Representatives. But in fact, there are only 10 Democrats representing Florida in the U.S. House of Representatives, and there are 17 Republicans, even though there are more Democrats in Florida than Republicans. Why? Because of gerrymandering. So the League of Women Voters and others sued the state before the Florida Supreme Court, and the Florida Supreme Court just ruled that the Florida legislature overstepped in gerrymandering for the benefit of the Republican Party, and they've got to undo it. Interesting stuff. We'll see where this goes. We'll see how far it goes and where it goes and, you know, what it does and all that kind of thing. But I think it's fascinating. And in fact, Ben in Miami, Ben, you wanted to talk about the very topic I was just talking about. Ben? Ben is not there. Okay, let's try John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to put a plug in for socialism. Socialism has brought us everything. You know, it's brought us the middle class. It's brought us the 40-hour work week, vacations. You know, it's just about brought us everything that makes a modern, you know, civilized society. And I think it's really interesting that it has such a dirty, you know, that people don't want to talk about it. But, you know, that's by design because, of course, they don't want to empower, you know, ordinary people. They want all the power for themselves. And I'm talking about, maybe I shouldn't use this word, but the capitalist class or the oligarchical class of people,
right,
that, you know, want to control everything. They're so hungry for power. And socialism has empowered people to do all kinds of extraordinary things. And even today, the $15 an hour, you know, push, you know, in Seattle, that was brought to you by Sharma Sawant, a socialist. So there's so many things that socialists have done, and if it wasn't for them, we'd be back at the turn of the last century, and I've said this before, but where, you know, 40 to 50% of the people worked as servants in the other 50% of the people's homes, and that was the only job that they could get.
Right.
Workhouses. Just think of Dickensian England. Think of the disparities that happened in the 19th century. That's what Reaganomics, and that's what the Republican Party would like us to bring us back to.
You're absolutely right. And that's the normal state of unregulated capitalism, by the way, is for there not to be a middle class.
Yeah, unbridled capitalism is a mess, and it's going to destroy the very fiber. You know, it'll destroy us, and it's also destroying the environment. You know, you were talking about global warming. I mean, they'd like to see it totally deregulated and just leave everything up to them.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally with you, John. Totally with you. Thank you for the call. Ben, in Miami, you want to try it again?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
I do.
Okay, great. So I actually have a list of the 8 districts they threw out. It's going to affect the election next year. They got to redraw before then. There's Ileana Ross-Leighton in Miami, Republican. Carlos Coberlo, who was just elected back in 2014. He's also Republican. Mario Diaz-Balart, Republican in Miami. David Jolly, who won that special election a couple of years ago in Tampa. And then 4 Democrats, Kathy Castor in Tampa, Ted Deutch in Boca, Lois Frankel in West Palm Beach, and Corrine Brown in Jacksonville.
Right. Very interesting. Thank you for that, Ben. By the way, since you live in Florida, I understand that Alan Grayson has announced that he's going to run for the United States Senate. Do you know anything about that?
I haven't seen it yet. I saw rumors that he was going to run, but I haven't seen that actually announced yet.
Yeah, I saw it today on Democratic Underground. We're working on getting him on the program to tell us all about it. But do you think if he were to run for the Senate, he's got a good chance in Florida?
For 2016, I think he has a better chance than it would have been on an off election year.
Mm-hmm.
Florida has a big problem of electing statewide Democrats to win a non-presidential election.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
So,
okay.
So,
Ben, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the information. I'm sorry, say that again. I stepped on you. I'm sorry.
I said since he'll be running in 2016, he has a pretty good chance of winning.
Right.
As long as we can get the vote out.
Right. There you go. It's all about voter turnout, which is what, you know, Dr. Lonnie Randolph had to say, you know, from South Carolina. Ben, thank you for the call. Jim in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Jim. Democratic Socialism?
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's up?
I want to talk about the Democratic Socialist and Capitalist, or Republicans and Democrats, I would choose to phrase it.
Mm-hmm.
The way I approach it is when I talk to a real conservative, I ask them if they believe older Americans should have a right to a retirement income, and they almost always say yes, and it's the right thing. I ask them, should all children have a right to an education? They say yes, it's the right thing. And I ask them, everybody have a right to health care? They say yes, it's the right thing. I say, that's the basic difference. Republicans basically want to do the right thing when it's profitable, and Democrats, for the most part, want to do the right thing because it's the right thing.
And you know, what this Republican ideology comes out of, I mean, increasingly it's just, you know, there's shills for the billionaires bought and paid for. But when it was being sold to us back in the, you know, from the 1930s forward, and in a big way starting in the mid-1970s through the 1980s, when the Powell memo was put into place and all these think tanks and efforts to capture politics and universities and newspapers and media and everything else were you know, rolled out in the 1980s. The idea was that a governmental agency trying to come up with policy about, for example, what should be the sales tax or what should be the tariff if we're importing things or what should be, you know, the rules of capitalism, that they would take weeks, months, you know, to come up with a decision, whereas in the marketplace there's literally a trillion decisions being made every second by consumers. And therefore, the marketplace should be making these decisions rather than democracy. And the argument, which was never explicitly said this way, but this was the argument essentially, is that market forces should replace voting. They should replace democracy. And we're halfway down that road right now. I mean, this is the essence of Reaganism. This was the core of the, and it sounds very seductive. This is the libertarian argument. The market is always smarter than the pointy-headed, bureaucrats. And the fact of the matter is the market may be smarter at figuring out how to get more money for itself. The market may be smarter at figuring out how to make more profit. But the market does not give a rat's ass about the quality of life of human beings. It doesn't care about whether workers have safe conditions to work in. It doesn't care whether communities can, you know, breathe clean air. It doesn't care if the water's poisoned or not, you know, unless it has to do with profit. And so, you know, the marketplace is really a very bad actor, as it were. It's really a bad metric to use to define what should be happening in the present and in the future. And democratic socialism, or what we used to call, the New Deal and the Great Society, which are really democratic socialist ideals, just took that on head on and said, no, we're going to rewrite the rules of capitalism. Glass-Steagall, for example, you know, you can be a bank or you can be a brokerage house, but you can't be both. And
that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
But the problem is that we on the left are the reasonable people, as I like to call us. We argue it on an intellectual level, and most Americans' eyes glaze over. We just need to keep it simple. Do the right thing because it's right.
Yeah. Yeah, we do the right thing because it's right. We're not motivated by the profit motive. Nothing wrong with the profit motive if it is appropriately constrained. But when the profit motive starts poisoning us, when the profit motive starts killing us, when the profit motive starts destroying our democracy, when the profit motive starts buying our politicians, when the profit motive starts putting hundreds of billions of dollars, multiple billions of dollars into our election process, then we have reached the cancer stage of capitalism. That is a cancer that is killing our country. It's killing our democracy. It's killing our people. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Brilliant. And thanks for listening or watching or whatever it is there in Fort Worth, Texas. 15 minutes before the hour, we will be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back. It's Anything Goes Summer. Welcome back. Let's see here. Who's watching on Free Speech TV? Liz in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. Hi, Tom. I had some reticence about addressing this on the air, but I thought, well, nobody's going to listen to me if I write a letter to the head of the defense, Secretary of Defense. But I thought, and it has to do with free trade. Why are we having anything that has to do with computers, given what happened yesterday, made in China or any other country, especially if it has to do with our security? How do we know? Do you know what's put in a computer chip? Do you know how it's modified? Do you know what they can track if somebody else builds it? I think all of this stuff should be made here, and it has to do not only with helping the people get jobs, but for our own security and common sense, yeah. For God's sake.
I agree. It is a matter of national security. We cannot build a cruise missile right now without parts from China. We can't build a Boeing aircraft without parts from China. We can't build a General Motors car right now without parts from China. We can't build basically anything consequential without parts from China. And if we were to get into a conflict with China, they can build anything they want without anything from us. So we're screwed. We gave it away.
For the raw materials. Yeah, but they can get those from someplace else. But it's nuts. And what kind of moron would do that?
Well, morons who are motivated by profit. I mean, this is the conversation we had in the last segment was unrestrained profit motive, unrestrained greed, unrestrained capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism. very often leads to very, in fact, inevitably always leads to, you know, very bad outcomes. And we can see multiple very bad outcomes as a consequence of all the massive deregulation during the Reagan era. Reagan came into office and one of the big think tanks here in town prepared a big binder with 3,000, you know, punch list. Here's 3,000 things that we want done. And Reagan got 2,000 of them done, or so the story goes. And, you know, things like, well, there's just a whole, you know, dropping the taxes on rich people, changing the rules so that they could be compensated with stock options, changing our trade policies, this long, long list of the ways that Reagan destroyed America. Will Bunch wrote a book called Tear Down This Myth that documents these things. In fact, we should get Will Bunch back on the program and just start going through it, because it's time to take down this myth that Reagan was some kind of great president. Reagan has destroyed America. Reaganism is destroying this country. And Liz, you're absolutely right. You walk into government buildings right now and you see computers made in China. And how do you know that there's not an EEPROM in there, an erasable programmable read-only memory, or a PROM, a programmable read-only memory that can't be erased? How do you know that there's not a PROM in every one of those computers that has a little back door to the People's Republic of China's hackers, or any country for that matter, Vietnam's hackers or Malaysia's hackers or Mexico's hackers? We don't know. And I find that very, very concerning. Liz, thank you for the call. And as Liz points out, if we were to bring that manufacturing back home, it would also provide jobs for our people, and that's got to be step one. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Chicago. Hey, Joe, what's up? You wanted to talk about redistricting in Illinois?
Yeah, hi, Tom. First of all, love your show, and I'm also an alderman here in Chicago in the first ward.
Whoa, good on you.
We went through our district redistricting and on the progressive side here, although we're all Democrats except for maybe one out of 50. I just wanted to point out, too, that it cuts in another way. So I'm part of the Latino caucus as a Mexican. And when we redistricted our wards, you know, the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund rightly said, based on the population, that we had to draw 13 wards that were Hispanic majorities. And, you know, those of my friends on the left said, you know, why don't we just draw them by computer? Why don't we do these things? And, you know, the Voting Rights Act has two protected classes, African-Americans and Latinos. And we can't simply do that because, you know, people are living different in ways. So, that's one thing to remember about this sort of, you know, transparent, equal redistricting, is there's two classes that are protected by the Voting Rights Act, and we have to acknowledge that on the left. And I think most people, you know, on our side would acknowledge that. Secondly, but, Tom, in Illinois right now, the right is trying to push for an amendment so that we redistrict, even though we have supermajorities of Democrats in our state Senate and our state House. So we just got to be careful when we talk about redistricting that it's just going to be it's a panacea for reform if we have them drawn by computers and et cetera, and don't have, you know, elected officials involved.
Right. So your argument is that if you had 100 districts and somebody's got 13% population, that 13 of those districts should be devoted to that particular racial group. Am I getting that right?
Well, according to the Voting Rights Act, so the Latinos and African Americans are protected classes because we're paying for sins of our fathers and grandfathers. They used to separate them, you know, African-Americans would be in a neighborhood, they would separate them into five different districts.
Right.
Then that became illegal. Then they packed them all into one district, 99%, so they could only have one representative. That became illegal.
Right.
If we would not have drawn 13 wards out of 50 that were Hispanic majorities, MALDEF, Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, would have sued, and they would have had a very strong case based on the population of Hispanics in the city, the same on the African-American side where we have about 20 African-American wards. So, you know, that's law. It's good law. And until we, you know, have a society that really does not recognize that, which I'm sure you agree we're far away from, we just have to be cognizant of that when we're speaking about.
But if those racial groups are living in you know, de facto segregation functionally. I mean, they're living in communities that are relatively homogenous and specifically right. Hispanic or African American. How does it matter whether those districts are drawn in a way that is essentially polygonal, or that, you know, they're drawn in a way that looks like a salamander? I mean, what difference does it make?
Well, it doesn't make any difference to me. What I'm saying is that those that look at our ward map and say, oh my gosh, how did you draw that Latino district? Well, more and more people are not just living in one specific neighborhood. They may be living on a side of the city, and to be able to draw that, to have them elect a person of choice. And again, this is law. This is our Voting Rights Act, right? So we have to recognize that when we're remapping, that if you just drew it by a computer, you would not have 13 majority Hispanic.
I think you're wrong, Joe. I think that if you drew it by computer, you may not end up with those 13 districts, but the only way that you could knock that down would be to say that that computer had discriminatory intent.
No, because the computer, if you took, well, take a look at the ward maps maybe offline and look at some of the Latino wards that you would say are salamanders.
Right.
The computer drew it and said, here's 10, and oh, by the way, now we have 10 districts that are majority Latino. Maldup would disagree with you and the computer and would go to court and say, there's not proper wards, districts that represent the amount of Hispanics that are in the city of Chicago. And they would win. They would have they would have a very strong case.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yes. I'm not all that familiar with how the Voting Rights Act affects redistricting, so I can't respond to what you're saying, Joe, other than to say thank you for giving me something to think about and learn about. Fascinating stuff. Thank you for the call. Detroit Johnny O. Hey, Johnny, in Romulus, Michigan. Please don't swear on the air.
Hey, great moments, Thomas.
Okay. What's up?
How you feeling?
Good.
You look great.
Thank you.
I just had a comment about our mayor and our governor.
Okay.
You know, they're both the same, man. They call themselves geeks, but they're not. They're really snakes in the grass.
Yeah, you're
there's
talking...
in Detroit down the river.
Yeah, you're talking about Rick Snyder and... I don't know who your mayor of Romulus is, but
Mike, the mayor of Detroit, Dugan.
Okay.
He's still in New York's buying Detroit.
Yeah. You wanted to talk about Scott Walker, though? I mean, I kind of floated this conspiracy theory.
You said about him was absolutely correct.
That the billionaires, the billionaires are pushing Donald Trump. I mean, he's part of the billionaire club to basically destroy any opposition to Scott Walker because the Koch brothers are behind Scott Walker. What do you think?
Yeah, Tom?
Johnny, yeah, you're on the air.
You there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Trump's just a distraction. Another one. I don't know, distraction number 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
We got a lot of them. And,
I think he's
doing this deliberately.
Yeah,
right. Scott Walker's the guy that's going to get chosen.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think
the Koch brothers and whoever else is involved.
Yeah, I agree.
Jamie Dimon is stealing Detroit for peanuts.
Yeah, there you go. Detroit Johnny, thank you very much for the call. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark.
Hi, how you doing? Good. I wanted to clarify something about, say, like Soviet communism, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what that is, what Soviet communism is really, it's not Marxism. It's kind of like a revisionist Marxism. It's Leninism.
Yes.
In Lenin's time, there was a big controversy within socialist circles about his methods. And Rosa Luxemburg, for example, and Karl Kautsky, who were ministers of parliament of the Socialist Democratic Party of Germany at the time, they were very, they were very critical of Marx.
Yeah. Mark, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have put you on the air because there was so little time. I missed the time cue before we came into the end of the show. But so, you know, call back tomorrow. We'll continue the conversation. Thank you all for being with us today. It's the end of the show. We will be back tomorrow. And for Anything Goes Friday and Anything Goes Summer. So look forward to seeing you then. And until then, democracy requires you tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.